This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama gets tough on climate change, kind of. Why some companies might miss the financial crisis. And guess which 80s hairstyle is making a comeback? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, June 25th. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's good to have you with us. As promised, the president today gave a historic speech on climate change, the first presidential address on that subject ever.
Americans across the country are already paying the price of inaction in insurance premiums, state and local taxes, and the costs of rebuilding and disaster relief. So the question is not whether we need to act.
And Obama's plan is to try and act on climate change without Congress, to regulate instead of legislate the way to cutting fossil fuel emissions. Regulations on power plants, new and old, on trucks and fuel efficiency, on buildings and appliances, too. And the emphasis was on doing all that without stalling the economy. Marketplace sustainability reporter Scott Tong joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Sarah.
So Obama has come out with a plan. What is he really trying to do here?
Well, part of what he's trying to do is to change the nature of the economic conversation in the country. Right now, it is a short-term talk about recovery and business cycle and jobs now. And this climate change conversation is a longer generational conversation about what the economy may look like, say, in 2050,
right,
to get from here to a low-carbon economy. And what was striking about this was the prominence he gave to natural gas. The president said we need to do a few things to get from here to there. And number one is natural gas.
Which is interesting, Scott, because he starts out a climate change talk talking about a fossil fuel.
A controversial fossil fuel, right?
Right.
I mean, we get it by fracking, and we've reported all about that controversy. It emits about half of the carbon dioxide of coal. And for proponents of natural gas, that's the point. The president called it a transition fuel to take us toward a future low-carbon economy without bankrupting our current economy. I just spoke to Professor of Energy Dan Kamen over at UC Berkeley about this emphasis on natural gas.
Coal is on the retreat right now, and natural gas is incredibly abundant and is very low cost. So swapping coal out and natural gas in is strategic because it demonstrates that these transitions are possible.
Now, Sarah, I do have to tell you that when we speak of transition, Kamen and others say, okay, transition number one is going to natural gas. Transition number two over time is to get beyond natural gas to renewables. And the climate experts say that is where we need to get to, say, in 2050, 2060.
Yeah. Now, the people who are really going to be affected by this plan are the folks who run power plants, right? I mean, were there any real mandates in this proposal on carbon, cutting carbon emissions?
Well, no specifics on how that's going to go. But here's what we do know. Targeting certain industries is not the ideal way to get to a low-carbon economy. You're focusing on power plants and on buses and trucks and buildings, and so it's not the most efficient way to get at carbon. But of course, a carbon tax or a more efficient way to do it would require Congress, and you know, we don't want to go there.
So, Scott, by regulating instead of legislating this, has Obama effectively taken care of the opposition?
Nobody believes that. I mean, the Republicans are already calling this an energy tax. They've called it crazy. They are certainly looking for ways to throw sand in the gears of the regulatory process, perhaps to sue it. I mean, this could be a stimulus act for lawyers.
and the coal companies, what about them?
They're first in line to fight it. I mean, their stocks took a big hit when we found out about this speech. So their lobbyists know what they're doing. We'll be hearing from them.
Okay. Scott Tong from our sustainability desk. Scott, thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Believe it or not, we're going to play the happy music today. Stock market details when we do the numbers. The financial meltdown in 2007 hurt a lot of companies on Wall Street. It even drove some out of business. But others, they managed to make money, cleaning up the mess. Consider all the lawyers that were needed when Lehman Brothers went bust, like the national law firm Weil, Gotshal & Manges. They've been working on the Lehman bankruptcy for years now, and that work is finally winding down. The law firm is about to lay off nearly a sixth of its staff. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes a look at the industry that emerged to help fix the financial crisis.
Mopping up the economic meltdown is big business. Stanford Law Professor Joe Grunfest describes the players as specialists.
Just the same way that there are recovery firms that specialize in fixing up residences after there have been floods or fires, there are law firms and accounting firms and turnaround firms that specialize in going into corporations and helping them get back up on their feet and fix the mess.
Wall Street firms were at the heart of the crisis, and many of the same firms made money in the cleanup. Damon Silvers served as the deputy chair on the congressional panel overseeing the Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Pretty much the full range of imaginable financial professionals found a way to profit from the disaster of 2008.
The government hired banks to help manage TARP and sell shares of General Motors. But lawyers led the pack.
I've been amazed at the size just of the legal bills.
But Silvers says the government didn't hire enough of a certain kind of lawyer.
There's been a persistent problem here that there have been inadequate legal resources directed toward enforcing our nation's securities and bank fraud laws.
So far, no one has gone to jail for their role in the meltdown. And even though the actual crisis is now in the rearview mirror, Silvers says the cleanup industry is expected to be in business for years to come. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Billionaire Mickey Arison is having an interesting week. The basketball team he owns, the Miami Heat, just won its third NBA championship. But Arison also just got pushed out as CEO of Carnival, the cruise company. Carnival is shaking up its management structure after a series of debacles that hurt bookings this year and the company's reputation. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
I've never been on a cruise, so I'm no expert here. But I do assume a couple of things. One, cruise ships should float, which wasn't the case with the Costa Concordia, owned by Carnival, which wrecked a year and a half ago, killing 32 people. And two, cruise ships should have functional bathrooms, which didn't happen on the Carnival Triumph earlier this year.
These are really big anomalies.
Matthew Jacob is an analyst at ITG Investment Research. He says after the Concordia disaster,
it really, I think, caused a good portion of the potential cruising population to reconsider.
The Triumph debacle, on the other hand,
I think you saw a similar impact, but it seemed to be localized to the Carnival brand itself.
Carnival Corporation's newest earnings report seems to show Concordia is in the rearview mirror, maybe a little bit more than the bathroomless Triumph is. Jamie Katz is an analyst with Morningstar. She says if you look at fleet-wide bookings, excluding the Carnival brand, they were higher and at higher prices.
Which indicates that the other brands are surviving pretty well.
But bookings on Carnival Cruise branded ships are lower than last year, at lower prices, which means now might actually be a good time to take that cruise. That, and the fact Carnival says it'll spend hundreds of millions of dollars to keep passengers safer. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Okay, here's how the romantic version of a startup goes. College student falls in love with an idea and launches a startup with a couple college buddies. Before long, they drop out of school to concentrate full-time on becoming billionaires. But what happens instead? Well, they burn through all their money, they max out their credit cards, and the business goes under. And then there's all kinds of talk about how failure can be a great learning experience. But as Sally Herships reports, there's a new twist on starting up a company, and this one comes with a different sort of education.
Venture accelerators. I'm going to use this term a lot, so before we get started, know that I'm talking about places that help entrepreneurs get their businesses off the ground. They provide office space and services like mentoring. Today, I'm in Soho, visiting an accelerator. Everyone's sitting at white desks, typing away on their laptops, because tonight is the year-end presentation, and investors will be there. What project are you working on?
My company is called Sold Through, and we do dynamic pricing and analytics for e-commerce retailers.
I'm talking to Mike York. This is actually his second startup.
And I should say that we're whispering because you're surrounded by other companies, right?
Should we go out in the hall for a minute? Is that okay?
And so how old were you when you started your other company?
I was 25.
So. When you know all.
Exactly. You realize that, yeah, it's funny. You really think you know everything.
But you don't. York's company failed. This time, he's working on his business with a lot of support. The accelerator he's in is part of a new program at Columbia Business School. It's free for recent MBA grads, and admission is competitive. The school covers the cost for the space, this year for 22 companies selling everything from hot sauce to vintage eyeglasses. And the whole thing is run by students. So what's changed? Didn't it used to be sexy cool to drop out when you start a startup?
I would actually not use the word drop out. I would use took an extended leave of absence.
Mark Meyer is director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at Northeastern University in Boston. The school gives out $250,000 a year in grants through its own new student-run venture accelerator. Meyer could have used that kind of help when he was a student at MIT in the 80s.
So very much, because you can be a brilliant technologist and be absolutely dumb about business.
Meyer's startup was a success, but many students and new entrepreneurs make the mistake of thinking they need just one thing to launch. Andrew Corbett is faculty director for Babson College's Venture Accelerator.
Yeah, the students at the beginning think it's money because they think they need money more than anything else, and they may need money.
But Corbett says they also need access to a network, and that's what these school-run accelerators can provide. Accounting majors can give pointers on balancing the books, and those tech geniuses can ask for help with market research. Of course, what everyone wants is investors and new customers. School can be good for those, too. Take tonight's event.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats.
Derek Lee is a Columbia alum, 2008. He runs a luxury real estate firm. He's also an advisor for Columbia student entrepreneurs and an angel investor.
I know what it's like from the other side to try to raise money and try to start companies. So if I can be a good mentor, hopefully the world's a better place.
What kinds of level of investment will you be making, you think?
The largest investment, probably $250.
$250K.
Each school has its own approach to sharing profits from the startups, but the seed money almost always goes to the students.
Babson's Andrew Corbett says it's good business for schools to offer these programs to their customers, parents, and students.
They recognize there's no or little security from working for a big corporation. They see entrepreneurial activity all around them, and they want it too.
And if you're wondering about the Mark Zuckerbergs and Sergey Brins of the world,
these people are off the charts, just super smart and super focused. And that's great. And what I would say is, hey, good for them.
Then there's the rest of us. So, kids, if you want to earn kajillions of dollars, stay cool and start up your business in school. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, the sides are usually like faded very close, and then the top is like a pencil eraser, like it goes straight up, you know, but it's usually flat on the top.
Yeah, it's 2013, but it's an 80s haircut that's all the rage. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rebounded 100 points, 2/3% to finish at 14,760. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 0.8% to wrap at 3,347. The S&P 500 bumped up 14 points, 1% to end at 1,588. Coal stocks rebounded some from that fall that Scott mentioned. Alpha Natural Resources was up 2.5%. Peabody gained 1.2%. Men's Warehouse racked up a 5.5% gain after the clothing store chain explained why it fired founder and pitchman George Zimmer. Apparently, Zimmer was pushing to take the company private. Walgreens dispensed with nearly 6% of its stock value after the drugstore chain missed profit expectations. Homebuilder Lennar had a strong earnings report and built a gain of 2/3%. Bank of America and Citigroup both climbed more than 3%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley each rose more than 2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department releases its final gross domestic product report for the first quarter. Are people bringing home the green giant? Minneapolis-based General Mills reports quarterly earnings. And in other supermarket news, let's go to the checkout line and listen to that beeping sound. It all began on June 26, 1974, when a pack of Wrigley's gum was scanned at a supermarket in Troy, Ohio, using a barcode. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ristall. Barnes & Noble is having a tough time transitioning to the digital world of books. Nook sales dropped 34% in the last quarter, and the company said today it will stop manufacturing the Nook HD itself and seek other alternatives. The Nook's been a drag on Barnes & Noble's revenues. Laura Owen writes for the technology blog GigaOM. Laura, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Laura, you were on that earnings call that Barnes & Noble had today. So is the Nook on life support, as someone on Twitter said?
Well, Barnes & Noble's Nook tablets are definitely on life support, or maybe they're just pulling the plug on them completely. Barnes & Noble announced this morning that it is going to stop manufacturing those Nook tablets in-house. It's going to try to partner up with third parties to produce the tablets instead in order to cut down on some costs. And it sees a brighter future for its black and white e-readers. It's going to keep developing those within the company.
So what's the basic problem on the Nook? Just all the competition in the tablet business?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of competition in the tablet business. You know, we have the iPad, we have the iPad mini, we have the Kindle Fire, and the Google's Nexus 7. It's never really been clear why somebody would necessarily choose a Nook tablet over one of those other devices. And so that's part of the problem.
They're black and white e-reader, though. People are buying that?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's doing fairly well. The whole Nook segment performed really badly. Revenues in that segment were down 34% this quarter,
right,
and 16.8% for the year. That said, it does seem as if Barnes & Noble's e-readers, the Nook Touch and the Nook with Glow Light, are doing better, and it at least sees enough of a future in those devices to keep making them. For now, that seems to be where the customers are.
What do you think this means, Laura, for Barnes & Noble's future as a whole? Is the company going to survive?
I definitely hope that Barnes & Noble survives. It's pretty much the only remaining bricks and mortar bookstore chain in the country. You know, it's a neighborhood place where people go and buy books, and there's fewer options to do that these days. One of the possibilities that has come up in recent months is that Barnes & Noble's founder, Leonard Riggio, would buy up Barnes & Noble's retail stores and its website, bn.com, and take those private. And that might be where the future of the company lies.
Laura Owen, she writes for the tech blog GigaOhm. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, the British Parliament debates a bill to launch a $50 billion high-speed rail project. It's called HS2 and promises to eventually cut travel time in half between London and other major British cities. HS2, the government claims, will propel British rail travel into the 21st century. But trains, the critics say, oh, that's so last century. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
HS2!
No, thank you!
HS2!
No, thank you!
With muted cries of HS2, no thank you, these protesters outside the British Parliament seem polite and restrained. But they could hardly make a din. Noise is mainly what they're complaining about. Back at their home in the tranquil Chiltern Hills, Roger and Jenny Waller voiced their concern about high-speed rail.
We're going to have 36 trains an hour zipping past here.
At 220 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And with all the dust pollution and the noise pollution, for those of us who moved here because of the tranquility, it will be devastating.
Recordings of high-speed trains in France and Germany only serve to raise the residents' anxiety. Meanwhile, in its promotional campaign, the HS2 company projects the grand, futuristic nature of the project.
High-speed 2 will be an engine for growth for the 21st century, one of the great infrastructure projects of the world.
The company claims the rail line will bring the country closer together, pump tens of billions into the economy, and create thousands of jobs. Jerry Blackett of the Birmingham Chamber of Commerce agrees.
We know when you put big projects in like this, you get new businesses setting up, you get jobs being created. Stuff happens when people can get to places quicker.
And what's more, without HS2, says transport analyst Jim Steer, Britain will be in trouble.
We will end up with a rail network that's congested and unreliable and unable to fulfil the needs of a growing economy. So we've got to think forwards.
But David Tice of the New Economics Foundation doesn't think HS2 is forward-looking at all. He reckons it harks back to the age of steam.
It's a bit of nostalgia. It's a bit of, oh, look at the great steps we made during the Victorian era. We can do that again now.
But we can't, says Tice. HS2 may cut some journey times in half, but in a small country like Britain, that's not a big deal. He says the UK should spend the $50 billion upgrading the existing rail network. And if it wants to be really futuristic, installing super-fast fibre-optic broadband across the country.
Investing in this type of future connectivity, as we call it, rather than thinking about connectivity in the 20th century context.
Tice says super-fast broadband would deliver a much bigger boost to the UK economy than high-speed rail. And it wouldn't tear through the tranquility of the English countryside. But the rail project is gaining momentum and pretty soon could be unstoppable. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you watched any basketball this season, you might have noticed a new hairstyle gaining popularity. Well, it's kind of an old hairstyle, actually. The high-top fade. It was the do to have back in the 80s. Think of the kids in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. And now we're seeing it on the likes of Norris Cole of the Miami Heat, as well as celebrities like Usher. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at the high-top fade and why it's back in business.
At Against a Grain Barbershop in Staten Island, Sean White says when he started cutting hair 27 years ago, the high-top fade was all the rage.
Well, the sides are usually like faded very close, and then the top is like a pencil eraser, like it goes straight up, you know, but it's usually flat on the top.
The high-top fade took the hip-hop community by storm. Big Daddy Kane, Salt-N-Pepa, Will Smith, they all had one. Rapper Kid of Kid & Play had a high-top fade that stood 10 inches high.
Hook up the high-top fade and I'm out of here.
White says he started noticing kids asking for the cut a few months ago.
I think the mohawk is almost done and now everybody's getting the flat top.
I think we really started to see it in this past winter. I like it. I think it's a great look.
Style expert George Brescia thinks the high top is replacing the mohawk because it's a lot more workable at work.
If you are in finance or you are in business, you know, how do you rock the mohawk? I think that this sort of has evolved out of the mohawk. It's a real versatile haircut.
Brescia says subtler versions of the high top fade can work on almost anyone. He says Robert Downey Jr. has a version. So does Kai Rizdal.
It's all about the high top fade.
30-year-old Malcolm Dior is a university administrator. His high-top fade is 5 inches high. Dior chose the style because it made a statement and had a professional feel. Not that it doesn't have its drawbacks.
There's gel, there's mousse, there's a blow dryer, there's a hot comb, and it's hard to maintain. It costs a lot of money, and it's a lot of work.
Dior spends $500 a month on product and weekly shape-ups. And then there's the labor.
How much time does it take in the morning?
It takes about 45 minutes.
The masses don't seem fazed by the maintenance. Barber Sean White says he does 4 or 5 high-top fades a week.
I love doing it. That's my era. I grew up wearing that, and I grew up learning how to cut hair on that type of haircut. So.
Plus, says White, they stand out, which is good for business.
Everybody looks at it and who did that? You know, it helps me out.
Oh, the importance of buzz. In Staten Island, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
So Stacy says Kai has a high top fade. I'm not sure I agree with that. Tell us what you think. Check out his picture on marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, a beef taco by any other name is a protein taco, apparently. Taco Bell is going to start testing a new protein power menu in Ohio starting in July. The idea is to double the meat in some of their menu items, limit the calories, and emphasize the protein part, not the meaty part. Researchers have apparently scoured the internet for our feelings about terms like meat and protein definitely wins the popularity contest. But hey, folks, it's still beef in the end. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rebounded 100 points, 2/3%. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 bumped up 14 points. That's 1%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeat. I'm Sarah Gardner. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.